Hi everyone, I'm Lee Stabert, Editor-in-Chief of Keystone Edge. Welcome back to PRISM, a podcast series produced in partnership with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. The goal of these conversations is to shine a light on the power of creativity in PA communities. In this episode, we're talking about the state's games industry. We've come a long way since the days of the arcade, and so has this fascinating field, which runs the gamut from large institutional degree programs to boutique video game designers. To help enlighten us, we welcome Charles Palmer, a professor of interactive media and executive director at the Center for Advanced Entertainment and Learning Technologies at Harrisburg University. Did you know they have one of the top esports programs in the country? Joining Charles is Jessica Crean, founder of I Can't Cone, a company that builds interactive experiences at the intersection of play and technology. We open our conversation talking with Charles about his career path and his evangelism for esports. Tell me about your relationship with gaming. Were you an arcade kid? Was this always something that you loved? And when did you first realize that it could be a career?
Yeah, so wow, that's I hadn't thought of my arcade days in a long time. Yeah, I guess I was an arcade kid, scrounging together some quarters to play Asteroids. But honestly, it wasn't until deep into my 30s that I moved from the world of production and started teaching in a games program in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon. And that was my true introduction to what is the career side of it and the academic and research side of it as well. In that particular space, we did a lot with working with students on how to work in the industry, how to find jobs in the industry, how to be games professionals. My contribution to that program was mostly from the production side and working with producers, helping students understand the production process, how to work as a team, how to engage with others, how to pitch an idea. Along the way, I was a game developer myself. I did mostly educational games, mostly middle school age games. That was a really odd contract work, but it was amazing to do.
When you were at Carnegie Mellon, did that program feel groundbreaking? Was it doing things that other places weren't doing? I know Carnegie Mellon has always kind of been in the forefront in certain areas in terms of robotics, et cetera. I didn't know about that, their gaming program.
I would say it was groundbreaking in a different sense. You know, so yes, Carnegie Mellon is a big research and computer science school, but this particular program was a collaboration. It was the School of Drama and the School of Computer Science, or engineering came involved as well. And so it was bringing, honestly, two fiefdoms that never really worked together well into this shared experience of entertainment, right? And you honestly can't have entertainment without both sides of it. You need the dramatic storytelling and you need the technology platforms in order to accomplish that for a user. And so it was groundbreaking in that sense. I would say that after the first couple of years of its successes, it then became groundbreaking because they made a number of I guess relationships is the best way of thinking out, with some of the AAA game companies where it served as a feeding ground. So students coming through our program, normally about 20 students a year, already had an internship lined up at a AAA games company. So that really got the ball rolling. And now it's great to say that I know students, you know, past students that are in most of the companies in North America that are in game development.
Very cool. And now can we talk a little bit about the esports side? I mean, if you had zoomed back to you in the 80s and said, okay, in the 2020s, this is going to be a $1 billion industry of people watching other people play video games, would you have been surprised?
Zero chance that that would be the case. I talked to a lot of parents and families about careers in esports. And I get a lot of incredulous, you know, parents that say, well, you know, my kid will never be able to find a job, or why do people even do this? And my analogy is always, you know, how much time have you spent sitting on the couch watching other people play football or baseball or hockey, right? We're used to observing others complete athletic feats, right? We're looking at the competitions themselves. Esports is just another form of athletics. It looks different. I've heard people sort of say, well, there's no dirt involved. There's just no real sweat involved. Until you go to an event or be a spectator or even watch it online, once you do that, then you'll make the switch. You'll be able to see that, okay, this is has all of the tenets that I see in normal competition, what we say normal or traditional competition. And esports is amazing. I love it. I love to spectate. I work with a professional team as well. And so it's just a wonderful space to be engaged in.
And how has Harrisburg University become this powerhouse? What was the genesis of that? Who were the people who helped push that forward and maybe even make the case to the university this is something worth investing in?
So there are two reasons that it was successful. And others are finally coming on board with this, but we jumped out early into this space to do this. And the reasons are is it didn't come from the bottom up. It came from the top up. Our president is a gamer. You know, he enjoys playing games. And so he recognized that this was a space that we could compete in. And so many schools have had the challenge of needing to convince senior administration that this is an endeavor that they should undertake. Here, it was the exact opposite. It was more of a, hey, we're going to do this thing. Let's figure out how to do it. And then the other side of it, to be honest, was investment of cash. Having the money to be able to go ahead and invest into that first year was really made the biggest difference for us. It allowed us to recruit at an international level. It allowed us to provide full-time scholarships for our athletes. Another thing that I think is interesting is HU has no sports programs at all. And so esports is the only thing, was the first thing that we started. And we have a volleyball team that plays, but for the most part, this is our space to play in. And so those things really allowed us to be out in front and, you know, national championships the first year out because we were able to recruit the best talent. Full ride scholarships go a long way to getting people interested in an academic program. And we were able to recruit individuals that always thought of going to school, but never thought they could do both, engage in their passion and go to college.
Next, we spoke with Jessica about her grad school epiphany and designing a tabletop game that lasts forever.
I was definitely not a gaming kid. I used to play Super Nintendo with my brother and my dad when they would let me, but that was really the extent of it. Mostly, I was just making up games with my friends. So a lot of my sort of game history as a kid was pure make-believe. So we used to make up games and puzzles all the time, but it was a very embodied experience, so it wasn't a lot on the tech side when I was a kid. And then I grew up doing theater, which is a very different kind of playing with a very different rule set. If you think of sort of having a script and a director and an audience as rules, it definitely fits into the world of gaming, but again, not a digital experience. And I ended up going back to grad school thinking there's got to be a way to get everyone involved. It feels so strange to me that it's so much fun to be making plays and so much less fun to be watching them, to be just observing. And for me, it felt like the heat of the experience was in those problem-solving moments in the room and being able to be collaborative with the people that you are in a rehearsal space with in order to tell a story and figure out what that story means and what everyone's roles are. And I loved doing that. And so I went back to school to figure out if there was more to it than traditional proscenium theater. And my last semester of grad school, I very much sweet-talked my way into being able to take a lot of classes at University of the Arts in Philadelphia. And one of them was a history of games class. And I really credit the professor, Adam Nash, with really changing the way that I think about what I do and really opening up the game space for me in a way that was both accessible and exciting. I learned about the games industry for the first time in that class and also started developing the first games that I ever worked on and found out that it was going to be a viable career path, that there were people who do this. And instead of sort of looking at the kind of work that I was doing and saying, these aren't games, he said, this is weird and you should keep doing it. And so he really encouraged me to know that there was space to experiment in this space and introduced me to the Philly Game Mechanics, which is an amazing community in Philadelphia where a lot of game designers sort of come together to do game jams. We essentially would take, you know, 2 weeks to form teams and make a game about whatever that month's theme was. And so everyone was sort of stretching their skills and meeting new people. And it's to this day one of the most supportive and generous game environments that I've ever been a part of. And so I credit them as well with helping me to realize that there is space in this industry for really unconventional and even non-digital forms of gaming. Even though they're primarily digital game designers in that group, it's not everyone. And they're always very willing and excited to see directions that other people are taking games and play.
Can you give me an example of one of these weird things you were working on that your professor encouraged you to keep going?
The first game I think I ever conceptualized and then ended up turning into a game was based on the work of the philosopher Erwin Schrödinger, who had this thought experiment, Schrödinger's cat, that essentially says that if you put a cat into a bunker with, there are a couple of different versions, but let's say radioactive isotopes, and you don't know if those isotopes have devolved to a space where they have killed the cat, and you don't open the bunker, you don't know if your cat is definitely dead. It could be alive, it could be dead, and so it's in this liminal space. And the thought experiment is sort of if you do open the bunker, then you can find out for sure if you are a cat killer or not. But if you don't open the bunker, then you also live in this liminal space of not knowing. And so I've always been interested in philosophy, and so I found myself wondering if I could make an infinite tabletop game, a tabletop game that has no end. And so I ended up making this tiny little mint tin game with a little cat and a couple of little tokens, sort of prisoner's dilemma style. It's for two players, and they both have to decide. One of them has to decide if their tiny little cat that's going into this mint tin bunker is going to be breathing out of a scuba apparatus or not, and the other player has to decide if there is going to be cat poison in that scuba in the scuba apparatus or on the rest of the bunker, and whatever air doesn't fill with poison will fill with oxygen. So again, very prisoner's dilemma. But once people make their choices, they seal it up with a little sticker, and the tokens are made out of a dissolvable paper, and so they have to destroy the option that they don't take. And so they really have to commit to the reality that they choose. And then the last rule of the game is to live with the consequences of their decision for the rest of their lives. And so we've had people playing at this point for a couple of years now since I first made the game. And so sometimes people will sort of pass the mint tin back and forth every month to, keep up their friendship and also to make sure that nobody's, opened the bunker. Other people have said that they're going to open it on their 1 year anniversary, which is pretty dangerous. But the real play of the game happens as soon as that action ends, because then the curious get really curious. And those who really don't want cat blood on their hands will try to convince others not to open it. I've seen people lie about what they've done. It really brings out this like really interesting psychological experiments of what people do, what they care about, and how they relate to the other player.
Can you now talk a little bit about your company?
The company that I run is called I Can't Go On Plays, which is a deep cut philosophy pun. Really what we do is sort of take the things that people usually think of as the things that they're most serious about in life and try to find ways to make them playful as a means to unlock our creativity, to help us think outside the box. Something that I had been observing for a while is that the more we care about things, lots of people tend to get stuck in their thinking around those things, even as we learn and get deeper into our own growth in that space. So how is it that we make those things that we don't necessarily want to think about or look at or shine a light on or grow into really fun and enjoyable? We're currently working on a mobile app that allows players to play through the 5 days of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet with a stranger, as a means to sort of figure out how do we relate to others who are maybe not a lot like us and sort of outside of our bubble, and how is it that we develop intimacy and maintain intimacy over a short period of time? The story itself is pretty fascinating. Romeo and Juliet end up getting married with less than tw after less than 24 hours of knowing each other, and so it becomes this really interesting question of how do we build and maintain bonds digitally? Do we want to maintain those bonds? Are some experiences left as these ephemeral moments for us, or do we sort of take a risk on continuing relationships with people? I also do a lot of climate change work, which falls very deeply into the space that we often don't want to think about, or view as such a serious problem that it couldn't have anything to do with play. But it does, and play helps us to stay energized and motivated to do the work that needs to get done.
You're listening to Prism on Keystone Edge in partnership with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, which believes that building stronger communities takes creativity. Learn more about how the council supports Pennsylvania's diverse creative sector at arts.pa.gov.
Now it's time to bring these two passionate Pennsylvanians together to discuss the local industry's strengths, the power of play, and the role mentorship has in welcoming new voices.
I think this is a really interesting pairing because, Charles, you've worked so much in sort of this more institutional, mainstream side, especially from the esports side. And then, Jessica, you're obviously doing things that are a little bit more on the philosophical boutique side. But my first question is actually about geography, because the one thing we all have in common is we're all in Pennsylvania. Is there a play to be made by Pennsylvania to try to put our flag down and grow the industry here and become associated with this industry?
I have to say that the Philadelphia game scene is amazing. I've been a distant observer of that scene for probably the last decade now, not just in the esports space, but in the game development space, the game jams that take place, the stuff going on at Drexel, the small communities that build up around gaming is just phenomenal. And so there are other areas around the state where similar things has happened, you know, centered around Carnegie Mellon and Pittsburgh. There are a number of small high-tech game spaces that are being built on. A lot of people who are just coming together and saying, hey, we want to work in this serious game space, or the stuff coming out of Shell Games, SimCoach are working on a number of things. But I, in all honesty, I think the ground roots effort going on in Philly is really a testament to what can be done in Pennsylvania.
I think that Pennsylvania has both the technical tops, like Charles was saying, especially with producers. It's so important to have good producers who know how to get games off the ground and into people's hands and minds. And so that tied to the, in my experience, the sort of acceptance of weirdness and experimentation that goes on in Pennsylvania, it's like nowhere else I've ever seen. Especially in Philadelphia, I have found that players and audiences have been trained to be delighted by surprise. And so they're not necessarily just looking for the next version of something that already exists. They're really excited to find out what's new and what new ideas are coming into the game space. And so that kind of support from the community is, in my experience, pretty rare and extremely valuable. So I think Pennsylvania is very well poised to be able to be the thought leaders in the industry in a lot of ways.
Do you have any questions for each other?
Jessica mentioned something that is so important that I think everyone knows about the esports space. You made a comment that said, when my brothers let me. And that stuck so hard with me. One of the things we're combating right now are the lack of women in esports. And it boils down to that statement right there. So many young ladies get interested in games, mostly or are interested in games, digital games, up until those middle school age years. The same space where we see with people leaving STEM. And what happens is their parents or their siblings have predetermined that games are for boys, or that digital games are for boys in particular. And that has been so detrimental to esports in general. Now, I will say that we've seen lately a resurgence of women in this particular space, young girls especially, and it'll be 10 years or so before we see them entering into the esports arena. But people don't realize how making that small sort of adjustment in their family life of saying, oh, you know what, let your brother play. You know, you can go off and play with your dolls, or you can go off and play pretend, or you can go and do these other things. And that step alone has really hurt the industry.
That's such a good call out. I was just talking to a friend of mine who also works in esports and does a lot of family support, I should say parental support within the space, and does a lot of what you were talking about in terms of basically telling parents that this is a viable path for their children, and also their children are passionate about it. So unless you want to, you know, really put the kibosh on that passion, this is something that you can integrate into your lives. And I was asking him about siblings and how siblings are involved in that process. And he was like, oh, they aren't. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so interesting. I think there's still a lot of growth to figure out how families play together. And a lot of families that I know, including my own when I was a kid, we used to play board games together. But it wasn't always fun. We had a competitive family, and so sometimes if someone won and someone else felt that they should have won, it was just mayhem. People wouldn't talk to each other for days on end. And so what could have been play ended up just being game. And I think something that's really important is sort of making both that distinction and also knowing that those things go hand in hand, that you could have games and have them not be fun or playful. And you can also have experiences that are not traditional games. And those things can be really playful for a family. And so figuring out what it looks like to have that balance, I think it is really important.
I'll just add to that, what happens at the tabletop is so vital to building relationships. I think more so than the digital space. I know myself, I had a number of friends while we were still in Pittsburgh that we would get together regularly to play whatever was the tabletop du jour. I know we played Settlers for quite a long time. Talk about creating situations where people stop speaking to each other.
I was about to say, so vicious yeah. In my family. the look on my sister-in-law's face when she knows she's winning, it's just could divide us forever.
Exactly. And so that Monopoly is another one. And but, you know, aside from that, people learn how to negotiate. People learn how to get along with others. People learn how to lose gracefully. And we don't see that as much in the digital space. It happens, but it doesn't happen in a shared space with other people so you can watch others grow along with you. And that's another thing that I think really is important, that families have sort of shied away from this idea of board games as a activity for the family. But I think they're important. I think they're almost crucial to watch the maturity of your children.
One of the best lessons I've learned from starting to work in games is the terminology around fail faster. There's a couple different versions in all different industries, like fail forward. But it's been crucial to me. I've always been someone who likes to fail in private. Even when I was a little kid, my parents didn't know that I knew the alphabet or that I could walk or crawl or write until I could do them up to my own standards to be able to share. And so What games necessitate in the making of games, especially, is that you have to get playtesters. You can't just make it in a bubble and release it into the world. You need to know how the interactivity works. And so you have to be putting your game out when it's not done yet, and very often when it's pretty bad in a lot of ways, in order to figure out if you're growing the game in the right direction. And so I really had to learn how to do that in a way that is graceful and doesn't leave me in tears after every playtest, because I have to put my imperfections out. And so just it's helped me grow so much as a designer.
That is one of the hardest things for our students. And that is to accept that what they're making right off the bat is not going to be good, but still sharing it with others. We do game jams here as well. And it's interesting with the game jams where we host them here at the university. We normally get about 30, 35 participants. But only, you know, less than a third of those are actually students. The rest are from the community. And talking with students, they almost always come up with this idea that, well, I'm not good enough yet. My great idea isn't there yet, so I don't want to share it. They don't feel like what they've done is worthy of accolades or being seen by others. And so they keep their light under a bushel. What they don't realize is growth can never happen in a vacuum like that. You need the input from others. You need to stand up there and defend your ideas or your approaches to something, and share it with others as to get their feedback from it as well. And so,
what do we still need here in Pennsylvania to grow the industry, make it vibrant, make sure there's room for everyone?
I think it really boils down to opportunities. We've seen a number of places that will do or help startups. I think we need more strategic places for that to happen, for those three or four friends that have an idea and a little bit of talent and they need a place to work or they need some funding to get to the next level. It's difficult for some of those groups if they don't have connections within the state government or within some of the organizations that are around to get a seat at the table to even talk about their idea or even where to go for funding and those sort of things. I think the other side of that funding is whoever is making those decisions has to also realize that games look very different depending on the individuals who are making them. And so as Jessica was speaking about earlier, you know, it's about play. And something that might not look like a game to someone who is always playing Call of Duty, that doesn't mean it's not a game, and it doesn't mean it's not going to be enjoyable by others, and it doesn't mean it's not worthy of funding or backing. It just means it is different, and there is a different audience for it.
Cheers to all of that. And I think mentorship can be really essential to that process. Having someone that you can turn to with the kinds of questions that are really scary to ask or feel really personal, or it feels like you're alone in the industry in a particular way. How do you get through those moments? Or does the industry, do you end up feeling shut out by the industry? I've seen it from both sides. I've seen people leave the industry because there wasn't support. And there wasn't necessarily a community in place to support the challenges of being here. A lot of that ends up coming down to representation in the industry. A lot of that, I think, has driven a lot of women out of the industry. I don't know, but I would guess that it's also driven a lot of people of color out of the industry or stopped people from getting involved in the first place. And so that becomes really, really dangerous. And so I think having mentors who are around to say, hey, this is how it works. This is what some of the struggles might be, but I'm here for you when those struggles happen. Let's figure it out.
If I can just add, that mentorship is so important. We had a young gentleman show up to one of our game jams who had no background in games at all. But he had been talking to one of his colleagues, one of his mentors, and they had suggested that this was something he did. And he's a musician. And so he literally shows up at Game Jam with a guitar and a little mixing device and proceeded to work with every team in the room creating music for their game on the spot. He was interested in games but knew nothing about game making, but he found the skill that he was able to provide one of the skills that he did have, and found a way of making sure that that skill could be utilized by the developers in the room. We've seen that with analog game makers. We've seen that with writers. We've seen it with artists come in and apply their talent into this particular space. Jessica, yeah, the question of representation is always a big one. I was speaking with some voice actors not too long ago, and I was amazed, I shouldn't have been, but I was amazed at how many of them were discouraged because of the color of their skin and the way they were treated, especially in an industry where you visually are not participating in the activity, right? It's your voice that's being lent. Representation is extremely important to encourage others who might look different than what they see in the community to come in and be part of it and feel safe as they do it.
So how do people find mentors? Any suggestions for someone who might be listening to this and think, oh, I would love a mentor?
You know, as I was saying that and listening to Charles speak, I was thinking, yeah, you know what we could also use some support for? Mentors. Because that is also, I think, in an ideal world, at least in my brain, those things sort of happen organically. But that too means that you're in a space where you're already can be open to that, or there are people who are open to that. And that isn't the case for everyone. So I think finding a mentor can happen by going to a four-year institution or a two-year institution that teaches game design. It could be that your mentor is outside the industry. Certainly a couple of mine are, and there's still resources for me within this space. But I do think that having sort of a concerted way to say, I would like to be guided through this process a little bit, who can I reach out to? If there were a pairing program for that in Pennsylvania, I think that would be truly fantastic. I don't know if there are any models for that. I'm sure there are, but I haven't come across them. Charles, have you seen anything like that?
No, not outside of the business world, no. You know, we've seen mentors where people say, hey, I've got I'm a young entrepreneur, or I'm a young innovator, and there are not think tanks, but sort of organizations where people can go and to be mentored through that process, but haven't seen them across in other industries. But you're right, that would be a great thing.
I ended up feeling pretty stuck in a particular aspect of game design at the end of December 2020, classic everyone's stuck time. And I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, the Farnham Street podcast, and I heard someone speaking and I was like, wow, that man's brain is very different than mine. I bet I could learn a lot from them. And I ended up cold calling their institution. I was like, hey, I'm an artist. Is there any chance that you would maybe want to talk to me about what you do? And one of their folks wrote back and was like, yep, I'd love to talk to you about this. And he's sort of helped guide me through aspects of entrepreneurship that I have zero training in for the last year. And in exchange, I've taught him about the relationship between clarity and play. So we ended up doing a bit of a skills exchange that has been really vitally important to my own growth. So there is something to be said for feeling a connection with someone and reaching out. It won't always pay off, but sometimes it will. And so it can be a numbers game of finding someone to help be a guide.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything you want to say about this industry or anything you want to say to someone out there who is thinking, this is the thing that makes me excited? I never sort of considered that I could also make a living at it.
I would say try it. It doesn't hurt. And if you have not been to an esports event, go and find one. Even if it's online, just go and watch for a couple minutes and you might not understand the game that's going on, but oh my God, you will see how exciting these events can be.
I love that. I would say to think about what play means for you and what it means for the people in your life. And if there are ways to come together around what that sense of play is, usually a really great place to start.
At the end of this discussion, Jessica offered herself up as a mentor for the game curious out there. You can reach her at her website, iCan'tKone.com. That's iKantKoan.com, or on her social media channels, at iCan'tKone. That's it for our latest episode of Prism. If you have thoughts on the conversation you just heard or ideas for what we should cover in upcoming episodes, please visit our website, KeystoneEdge.com, and reach out. You can also message us on Facebook or Instagram. Until next time.